Yes, I do, Sister White.
We will not fear.
The kingdom is alive. The kingdom's on the move with the poor and the meek and the hungry and the lonely.
I'll never forget it.
Welcome to Adventist Voices, Spectrum's podcast. I'm Alexander Carpenter, and I'm honored to be back with historian Gil Valentine. Thanks so much for continuing to talk to us about your book, Ostriches and Canaries.
Thanks, Alexander, for the invitation to join you again in some discussion. I've enjoyed it.
Me as well. So today we're moving on from Robert Pearson to, we could say, the man in the middle, Richard Hamel, president of Andrews University during much of the time covered in your book. Tell me who Richard Hamel was.
Richard Hamel was a product of the Northwest, a product of the financial recession of the 1930s, product of a home where mother was an Adventist and father wasn't. He became an Adventist later in his teens, in fact, just when he was turning 20. A very bright person, very intellectual, and a person of vision. He really did have a vision for building the education system of the church and was committed to that. So many, many things. Perhaps I could relate that his background from Eastern Oregon, he came off a farm and then moved to Western Washington again on a farm, kind of a hard scrabble farm, wasn't very wealthy. He endured quite a bit of hardship in his teens. And his parents originally had been Church of the Brethren people. His mother became an Adventist when he was about 14 years of age, and she was the only one. Maybe his sisters became an Adventist, but he didn't become an Adventist at that time. So kind of that background shapes a person, shapes their values. He lived on a farm where he says that out of the windows of his house, he could see Mount Rainier and Mount St. Helens. And he loved the out-of-doors, and yet for most of his life he was confined to an academic office, administration office in the cities. So he kind of treasured holidays, going out into the outdoors, and was a bit of a loner in that. He liked trekking by himself and wandering the woods by himself. So that shaped him.
That's interesting background. You mentioned values. Can you talk about some of the things that he valued? He compared to many Adventists, he was quite serious about his academic studies in that era, and in many ways parallels the track of the canaries in the book in his educational interests. What did he value?
He valued economic thriftiness, for one thing. that was his background. And when he was going through his study program, I mean, he took his doctoral degree at the University of Chicago in Old Testament studies, but had to crowd it into 2 years, coursework and dissertation, because of the impositions of the economic situation. He was academic dean at the time. Southern Missionary College, and money was scarce, so he had to do on a very tight financial plan. So that shaped him significantly, and in his later administration. It also helped him to be committed to the church, I think. He was very committed to the church as an institution and to its academic programs. He was committed to learning. I mean, he was the kind of person who, even in a very tight academic program at the University of Chicago, would take a number of courses outside of his scheduled program of study just to learn. I mean, he took audited a number of courses in anthropology. So he had broad interests and was committed to the church being academically credible. So that was a very important strand of who Hamel was. When he served in the General Conference from 1955 through to 1963, his role was to foster graduate study and graduate interests. He chaired the meetings every 4 years of the college teachers, religion 1 year, science the next, and understood the needs of higher education. And of course, it was in under his leadership, even as an assistant in the General Conference Education Department, working with Cosentine, that he fostered the development of graduate programs for science students, for science teachers in the area of geology and ancient earth history. It was really his coordination from the General Conference that led to the establishment of the Geoscience Research Institute. So he had that kind of commitment, genuinely committed to improving the academic credibility of teachers and the church's education system.
And then Robert Pearson comes along. And for much of your book, Richard Hamel seems like a man in the middle. He's caught between the General Conference president and his academic community, especially the seminary faculty. Talk about, if you will, that position that he was in and what sort of pressures he was under.
Yeah, those kind of pressures put Hamel in a very difficult situation quite often. He faced enormous pressures when he was president of Andrews University. I mean, his coming into the office as president was in a very turbulent time, when the seminary and the graduate school were merging with Emmanuel Missionary College, and they ran into troubles over how this whole new entity should be structured, making the transition from General Conference, Lake Union Conference ownership to General Conference ownership was a very difficult time, and they didn't really understand how to structure it. So that was worked out by experiment over time. And so when he came into the office, he already right at the outset had difficulties with the accreditation process, and they almost lost their accreditation, placed under probation for a short while, with the outgoing president of Emmanuel Missionary College being upset with the way the transition was handled. So one of Hamel's first tasks was to secure a stable accreditation. And he had visions for introducing doctoral programs. I mean, a university couldn't be a university without offering doctoral programs. So he was committed to that put a lot of energy into recruiting the kind of faculty that would make the offering of doctoral programs at the seminary and at the university possible in the education field and in the theological religion field. But to do that under tight budgets put him under pressure.
Sure.
And to do that with an administration of the university, the board administration, being a very conservative board, also put him under enormous pressure. So he had to negotiate very difficult minefields, in a sense, keeping the accreditation bodies happy, recruiting the kind of faculty that would meet accreditation standards, and yet coping with the pressure, a very conservative pressure, a church administration that wanted a very conservative campus, put him under significant pressure, made for long days, difficult personal situations, both with faculty and with the students. I mean, this was a time also when there was huge social change going on in America. The time when Pearson was president and the time when Hamel was president of the university was a time when students were resisting authority. They didn't want to be under a tight administration. They wanted more of a voice in university affairs, and Hamel had to cope with that. and to be the diplomat, and yet also to represent the university and its administration. So it was a very difficult time for Hamel during these periods. And of course, through all of this, there was still the financial pressure. He had to do things with a tight budget. So difficult time to be a president of a university.
Well, in your book, in page 201, you quote from a letter that has to do with Hilgert and Kubo, but it's written by Dick Ritland. And I'll just read what you wrote here. Mm-hmm. Ritland realized that Hamel's hands might be forced with, quote, no alternative. And he sympathized with the well-nigh impossible administrative problem, end of quote. I thought that's interesting that sort of he's a man in the middle, perhaps caught in a box canyon. Yeah. And what were some of the ways, perhaps if you could talk about maybe a way that he was able to craft a way forward, and then maybe if you would talk about a mistake that you, looking back, that you think that he made.
Yeah. Hamel had had experience previously in his ministry of coping with environments that were hostile. He spent 4 years in the Philippines in an internment or under Japanese occupation. And the story of his escape from a Japanese internment camp is really quite dramatic. The paratroopers came in and landed in the camp, and he was taken out by tank. He had to jump on a tank and flee from the camp. So he had learned to cope with the administration that was not very friendly. And I guess that helped him to understand the ethics of making compromises, but helped him to know how to survive when survival was important, and still maintain one's personal integrity. And that's always a difficult challenge. He faced that kind of challenge during his administration at Andrews, where the administration was not hostile against him personally, but were hostile in the sense that they were expecting a conservative environment where it wasn't possible to actually deliver one fully. So the pressures of accreditation meant that at the seminary, they had to offer courses that really introduced students to studies beyond Desire of Ages. They had to really, in fact, it was an intentional modification of the curriculum in the seminary to expose students to the synoptic problem and to the problems of the New Testament. They felt they had a duty to do that. And so, of course, teachers had to introduce students to that. And that troubled Hamel and troubled those in his immediate circle. Hamel himself was familiar with the issues because of his study at Chicago. He'd been a long-term friend of Earl Hilgert, the New Testament professor. They'd been college mates at Walla Walla. In fact, I think Hilgert had been the best man at Hamel's wedding. And Hamel at Walla Walla had studied under Frederick Schilling, who the year after Hamel's graduation, Schilling had been squeezed out of Walla Walla for his own suspected heresy. So Hamel was familiar with the issues, and Earl Hilgert is quoted as saying he knew where the skeletons were in the cupboard, so to speak. So he was familiar with the issues, understood what his faculty had to do, and yet when the pressures came on from the board and from Pearson in particular, he felt that he had to make some compromises and balance the set of interests for the welfare of the institution and for the survivability of his budgets and the accreditation process. So he pushed back against Pearson. He defended Jim Cox. He defended Gottfried Oosterwahl. He found a place outside of teaching for Sakai Kubo when critics from the General Conference were out for the scalps. That's the language being used. They were out to get the scalp of Hilgert and the scalp of Sakai Kubo. So Hemmer was able to find a place of safety for them. But when the pressure became even more intense, and that was produced by criticism from the General Conference, channeling, I think, criticism from conservative ministers in the field and conservative church members. So it was all a mix in this. Hemmer had felt that he had to let one or two go. I think he would have really preferred to have kept Ted Vick on staff, but the pressure was too great, and Ted Vick's position was terminated. He just wasn't renewed, and they found a careful way to do that within the HR policy. But it was not something that would have been his first choice. Mm. He would also have liked to have kept on Earl Hilgert, but Earl Hilgert felt that he was at a stage in his career where if he stayed on at Andrews, his future wouldn't have been secure. And these were the days when sustentation was a manipulative tool that the church could keep over your head. If you got out of favor with the church and were terminated, then you lost all retirement benefits. That changed later.
Sure.
And made for a more stable environment and made easier administration. But I think Hemmer felt very badly about having to let go, let Hilgert go, and regretted that, as he regretted the loss of Schilling, his teacher at Walla Walla.
Well, let me play devil's advocate here, if you don't mind. You know, in reading your book and talking about your book with folks, I've heard others describe him, students there at Andrews at the time, calling him mousy in their interactions with him and feeling like he wouldn't really stand up for things. And, you know, others have talked about the kind of, you know, one person's compromiser as another person's chameleon. Mm-hmm. And was there a sense that people could trust Hemmer to stand up for them, or was where were his loyalties?
They were divided loyalties, I think, because he did have a loyalty to the church and to his board. He felt a responsibility to the board, and he wanted to stay as president of the university in order to secure the offering of doctoral programs and to build its reputation. He'd invested a lot of his life, actually, in getting the university started. His years in the General Conference Education Department, many of those had been devoted to readying the church broadly for the establishment of universities, both Loma Linda and Andrews. I mean, he'd worked closely with Cosentine in creating a culture that would accept the establishment of universities. So he was committed to that and valued the university. And he recognized that if he didn't protect his flanks, in a sense, he would lose his job. In fact, when he did leave the university in 1976, it was because the board chair was taking advice from the business department and not from the president. And Hemmer felt that he was being white-handed and undermined. And he was aware of that dimension earlier. So part of the trade-off, I guess, of sharing some of the intellectual convictions of his faculty and yet having to let them go because he couldn't manage the pressure and maintain his position of the university president, not just for his own personal benefit as president, but because he really did want the university to thrive and survive. A very difficult situation. And I'm sure that some people could with legitimacy say that he'd been mousy in his defense of them. So how to read the balance there? I wouldn't have liked to have been in his shoes, actually, to try and balance the intellectual integrity, the personal integrity, knowing that Jim Cox And Gottfried Oosterwaal understood the problems of Genesis, and he understood them, and yet wanting them to be publicly in support of the traditional positions, and he was able to hear them say that so that he could report that to Pearson, knowing that the language he was having to use was very careful and very, very carefully chosen. So, you know, it's a difficult situation to be in. And I think the challenge that he faced was even more difficult when he moved to the General Conference and Willis Hackett wanted him to be on board. And in fact, he had to, as a company man, go around the colleges and try and sell these confessional statements. And he was uncomfortable in doing that, but he had to speak for the administration in doing that. I don't know how he coped with that. And he himself recognized that that was the role of the company man, and he had to live with that. He faced the same dilemma in 1980, I think, during the Glacier View problem, where he understood the issues and yet felt the church couldn't quite make the journey to where Ford wanted it to be in a short time. So he adopted a slow approach, and some thought that he compromised his integrity, and perhaps he did, in order to survive in his role to serve the church.
Well, you let Jude have the last word in your book. You get the penultimate word, but Richard Hamel is he's the third to the last person that you give quotes to in your book. And on page 432, you quote Richard Hamel, noted several years after his retirement, quote, "Adventists are encountering some very persistent and painful facts which require calm, thorough, and honest investigation." You write, he cited the economist Lester Turow, who had observed that facts are difficult to deal with when they conflict with theory. And before changing theories, most human beings will spend long periods of time pretending the facts do not exist, hoping that the facts will magically go away, or denying that facts are important. That's significant, coming from Hamel, or at least a quote quoted by Hamel. Why did you decide to end your book with Hamel there?
I think Hamel as a person illustrates very well the dilemma of the church as a body, as a corporate entity, that he himself came to terms with the facts slowly. He justifies his slow journey by saying that during his time in administration, he didn't have the time to put into thorough research and to writing articles. And I think that's true. I mean, he felt pressured to compress his doctoral study into those 2 years. And he regretted that, actually, that he was under those constraints. Later, when he was administrative leader of the university, he felt he didn't have time to really get into researching ancient church history, but he understood the issues. He talked to people, he talked to his science faculty, and he understood where the facts were, but felt that he didn't understand it thoroughly enough to go out public and make a stand on a mountaintop on the issue. Only after he retired did he really feel that he had the time to study both the sanctuary issue and ancient earth history issues, which is a tragedy, really, because he was more outspoken, still diplomatic, still concerned for the welfare of the church. But the chapter in his pilgrimage book that didn't get published because he felt it was still too sensitive, looked at the issues of Glacier View and his own personal position by that time, while differing on the the potholismatic principle, certainly was different to the church's position on the sanctuary. It was a position even in advance of Heppenstall's position. You know, he felt that we really needed to redress the whole sanctuary doctrine issue. But even when he published his Pilgrimage, he didn't feel that it was safe enough to publish that chapter. And it's still only quietly circulating. He was able to come out more openly on the age of the earth issues. And I think his comment that we come to terms with the facts slowly, but they are the facts and we can't deny them, was a journey for him and was a constant source of how to balance the welfare of the church for my own individual understanding. And the church will eventually have to come to terms with those facts too. It's a challenge still before them, for us as a community. So I think he illustrates well his own personal dilemmas and the dilemmas that the church confronts as a corporate entity.
It sounds like
the journey before us.
Yes, well, there's some lessons to be learned there. It sounds like there is a later Hamel, and there's a little discomfort for me in thinking about that, in that I feel like it's just differences of time. You know, it's almost so aleatory and random. You have a scholar who has had the time to understand something like the age of the earth in 1969, and they understand the facts and they're ready to integrate that constructively into Adventist doctrine, but it's uncomfortable for someone who hasn't had the time to understand those facts. And whoever has the power at the moment and wherever they are in their understanding really determines reality and financial security. You've been an administrator as well as a historian. Is there any hope here?
Yeah, a good question. But really, Alexander, I think in spite of the dilemmas and the pressures, I think the church is becoming mature enough and robust enough intellectually and doctrinally to cope with the diversity. I remember Jim Cox saying to me once that if you've got a hen on a nest and you know that one of the eggs under that nest, under the hen is bad, it's gone off, you can't upset the hen on the nest just by removing the egg. You've got to put another egg in its place and gently keep the hen settled on brooding on the nest. And he said that's the way it is with the church. Change happens slowly. You can remove the faulty parts of our, I mean, a nest full of eggs is probably not a good metaphor for a doctrinal structure, but we got
the point. I've heard so many, a string of beads. So I'm ready for a nest. Yeah. At least something fertile is happening.
Yeah. I think the longer the church goes on and the fact that the clock keeps ticking and we face each new day, that the church will come to terms, we'll find ways of discovering the essence of our teaching, the essence of those key doctrines which speak to large issues rather than the nitpicky of the details of how they're constructed. And that's an ongoing task. And we've got people these days who can help us do it well. Lawrence Turner, for example, who has a brilliant way of helping us find our way through those things. Rainer Brunsma is doing that, and other teachers. So, I'm hopeful that we can continue to live together and become more diverse and cope with the facts that will continue to trickle onto the screen of our future, even as we move forward.
Well, thank you for your encouragement. We could stop there, but I do have to ask, because you've referenced Glacier View and that had some, your research about Glacier View had some role in you taking on this history of 1966 through 1979. Can you talk a little bit about what you're thinking about doing with the history around Desmond Ford?
Well, I've been collecting a lot of materials, and there is a lot more material becoming available about that particular major event in Adventist history. But I'm working, first of all, on a project on Heppenstall. I'm working on a biography of Heppenstall, who was Ford's teacher and Ford's mentor, and was distressed when things broke open in 1979, 1980, and found himself having to pull back from where Ford was, even though he was a teacher himself who saw the bigger picture of things. So Heppenstall himself was a little like Hamel, caught in the middle. So I'm working on that story as a way of working towards the Glacier View story, which is a story that does need to be told, and hopefully it can be told in more detail at a later time.
Nice. It sounds like you're really working all the angles here, so I appreciate all the labor you're putting into that. Well, thank you so much for talking to me about Richard Hamel. Next time we talk, we'll talk about Siegfried Horn, and I'm really looking forward to exploring his role in this narrative.
Thanks, Alexander, for the invitation to join in the conversation this morning. It's really stimulating. Thank you.
Yes, I do, Sister White.
We will not fear.
The kingdom is alive. The kingdom's on the move when the poor and the meek and the hungry and the lonely